This is Lori Grenier. You've seen me on Shark Tank. I'm always hearing from business owners who just can't get the money they need to grow. It's time for funding to catch up to the 21st century. It's time for Cabbage. Fill out the application online and you'll get a decision in minutes and could have access to a line of credit of up to $100,000. No waiting, no hassle. Cabbage is the real deal, A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau and twice a Forbes top 100 company. So go to cabbage.com. That's Cabbage with a K, K-A-B-B-A-G-E, or call 888-CABBAGE.
Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jazzwall Report, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a show about the world's greatest feeling, the feeling of love. Now, I would have normally been able to do this kind of show all by myself, but I was told to bring in an expert instead. So you guys are lucky. You get not one, but two world-class speakers on this great and enigmatic emotion. The L to the O to the V to the E. It's all about love today. And my guest is Dr. Helen Fisher. She's the chief scientific advisor to the internet dating site Match.com. She's conducted extensive research and written six books on the evolution and future of human sex, love, marriage, gender differences in the brain, and how your personality style shapes who you are and who you love. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Good to be with you.
Now, you're the chief scientific advisor. I want to know, when did love become a science? Because I always thought it was an art. You know, the art of lovemaking, the art of romancing. Doesn't science make love sterile, whereas it should be fertile?
Well, it's always going to be fertile. You know, people. I've studied love for over 40 years, and people will ask me, does it ruin it for me, knowing what I know about it? Does it make it sterile? And I think, you know, you can know every ingredient in a piece of chocolate cake, but when you sit down and eat that cake, you feel the same joy that everybody else does. So bottom line is, I know a great deal more about love from studying it scientifically, but it certainly can never ruin that, the ecstasy, the euphoria, the anxiety, the focused attention, and the craving for a human being that is romantic love.
Beautifully said. Has love changed over time? I mean, what does love look like in the 21st century?
Well, first of all, I just need to define really what we're talking about. I think that we've evolved three distinctly different kinds of love in the brain. The sex drive, linked with testosterone in the brain. Mm-hmm. Romantic love, that elation, giddiness, euphoria, focus, linked with the dopamine system in the brain, actually. And the third brain system of attachment, that sense of calm and security you can feel with a long-term partner, linked with other chemicals in the brain. So in the 21st century, I think love is changing dramatically, actually. We're seeing a real pre-commitment stage to romantic love. You know, in the past, first you married, and then you got to know your partner. These days, marriage is the finale. And, you know, we get to know somebody very slowly with the one-night stand, with the friends with benefits, with living together for a long period of time. I think these days people want to know everything about a partner before they tie the knot.
But that's more knowledge, right? I mean, has the style of love changed?
Well, the way we meet people has definitely changed. You know, I do work with Match.com, the internet dating site, and technology is changing how we court. We now court on the internet. We send emails and texts, and we arrange dates differently. Mm. But when you sit down and meet that person in a bar, in a coffee house, on a park bench, the ancient human brain clicks into action, and you court and love the way we always do. You smile the way we used to. You cock your head this way. You listen attentively that way. You try to show your best traits in the way we've been doing it for millions of years. So love has not changed. But the way we court is changed by technology.
Well, you say love hasn't changed, but the style of love, what isn't love anymore?
What isn't love anymore? Well, there's all kinds of things that aren't love. I mean, you know, I don't know. What do you think? You're an expert in this. What do you think isn't love? I mean, you know,
I think what isn't love anymore?
Exercise isn't love. Feeding your children is love, but it's a different kind. It's attachment.
Well, to me, what isn't love anymore is, I think, for better or for worse, is not a phrase that people follow much longer. I think loyalty is less. And it's easier to get divorced, so people do opt out for that. If you look at the divorce rate, it's very high.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm an anthropologist, and on the grasslands of Africa millions of years ago, a woman and a man tended to have two or three marriages during the course of their lives. Why? Because if it was a bad relationship, they walked out. They could, because women were economically powerful just as men were. So they lived in a double-income family, and they could walk out of a bad relationship. Mm. I do not think that today people walk out of bad relationships. I mean, walk out of good relationships. They walk out of bad relationships. Mm. And, in fact, I'm very optimistic about the future, because with this long pre-commitment stage before you marry, you can get rid of bad relationships in order to make good ones, so that by the time you walk down the aisle, you know what you've got, you want what you've got, you're determined to keep what you've got. And so I did a study of 1,100 married people to see if we're seeing happier marriages today just because bad relationships can end before you tie the knot. And sure enough, when I asked the question, would you remarry the person you're currently married to, 81% said yes. And I think that's because we're so cautious now, we're getting to know everything about somebody first. And by the time we're in a marriage, we're in a happy marriage. I think we're going to see happier marriages.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, in terms of love, it's such a difficult emotion to quantify or even qualify. Do you think people should fall in love with a person for who they are now or for what they're going to be in time?
I think we all want both.
No. Yeah. I don't think so at all. I think some people, some of the divorces that do happen are because one of the partners or both partners evolve over time. They change or whatever. And I guess when they first met, they didn't realize what it takes for that person to become what they're going to be later on.
I agree with you, but I do think that the brain is very well built to try and figure out what the person is going to be later on. I mean, we want to know, does he have a steady job? Is he kind to children? Can he cope with my parents at Christmas or whenever? I mean, the brain is very well, you know, we only have so much metabolic energy and time to court and mate and fall in love and pass our DNA on to tomorrow. So the brain is very well built to look at the gains and the losses, what's good about this relationship and what's bad about it. One of the problems, and I think you're right about this, is that when you're first madly in love with somebody, parts of the brain linked with decision-making actually shut down. So you're not running with a full range of intellectual beliefs. So I do think you can overlook the future when you're focusing on the present. Yes, I do.
So isn't it important to know what's involved, to where the person's going to be in a given amount of time?
I think it's extremely important if you want a long-term relationship. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, we're marrying later and later. And so we have this long, as I mentioned, pre-commitment stage to get to know this person. So the early intense infatuation can wear off to some extent. You can see what kind of person they're going to be around your family, around your friends, whether they're lazy, whether they're good at what they do, whether they're kind to you, whether they listen to your needs in bed and outside of bed, etc., so that you are getting a clearer view of what they're going to be down the road.
So is love actually the acceptance of negative traits? Because people who stay in the marriage, there's that, you do suffer from the loss of infatuation. The person becomes less attractive over time. But you still stay on, obviously, because of the love of that person. And, you know, bad habits start to emerge and things like that. So is love actually just the acceptance of negative traits?
I think, first of all, you know, I put people in brain scanners and study the brain circuitry of romantic love, rejection in love, and people who are in love long term. And it is absolutely possible to find the person who will continue to make you feel romantic feelings long term. All of these people we put in the machine, brain scanner, using functional MRI brain scanning, were married an average of 21 years. The vast majority had even grown children, and they reported that they were still in love with their partner, and indeed they were. But this is what we found in the brain, and I think you're right about this. There's a brain region that is linked with looking at the negative. Mm. There's a brain region linked with looking at and remembering the negative. And when you're in love long-term, you're able to overlook the negative. Activity in that part of the brain recedes, so you overlook what you don't like about the person and focus on what you do. So, in fact, there's three brain regions that are linked with long-term happy marriages. One of them is a brain region linked with empathy, having empathy for your partner. Mm. The second is a brain region linked with controlling your own emotions. And the third is this brain region linked with positive illusions, the ability to overlook what you don't like and focus on what you do. So there's all kinds of psychological tricks to making a long-term relationship, but the brain is built to find and keep a long-term happy partnership. I don't agree that that romantic love has to dissipate, disappear, or that all the negatives have to overshadow the positives. You got to pick the right person, though, kid.
So what am I to get from this? If I'm going on a date with someone, I'm saying, you know what? Before I propose, why don't we go for a scan?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to do is you're going to want to see what kind of lover they are. It depends on what your religious views are, too. But
I love being in love.
Well, we all love being in love, that's for sure. As long as it's a happy love, love is an addiction.
But you see, the way you're coming across, it sounds so clinical. It almost puts me off. If I was single,
it would be romantic.
Yeah, it would remove the romance from it.
Well, as I say, I've been in love many times, mm-hmm. and I've had a long-term relationships with men. And
you put them through a scan?
I did not. But you know what?
Mm.
You're touching on something that's very important to me.
Sure.
Romantic love is extremely happy thing under most circumstances.
Oh, yes.
But around the world, people pine for love, they live for love, they kill for love, and they die for love. It's one of the most powerful brain systems the human animal has ever evolved. Mm. And the more we know about the brain, the more we can help people make happy marriages. So the clinical is going to help. I wouldn't do it if it didn't.
Why then do people fall out of love?
I don't know, really. I think that some people, they grow into other things. I just wrote this book that came out 2 weeks ago called Anatomy of Love, and I looked at divorce in cultures around the world, 80 cultures around the world. And as it turns out, if you're going to divorce, you tend to divorce during and around the fourth year of marriage in much of the world. And it began to occur to me maybe millions of years ago, we evolved the drive to fall in love and form a pair bond and stick together at least long enough to raise a single child through infancy. And once a child can join a multi-age playgroup, they call it, where the child can be cared for by, a 5-year-old can be taken care of by the 10-year-old and a 15-year-old and aunts and uncles and cousins, the pair bond or the marriage could break up. So I do think that we have natural weak points in our relationships, and the more you understand those weak points, the more you can work around them to continue a good marriage.
So it's really about realizing what the weak points are and seeing whether they are acceptable or not.
Exactly. And I think one thing is, we're finally in an age where you can walk out of a bad relationship. For 10,000 years, a man and women were stuck together till death do us part, and they weren't all happy. That they couldn't walk out. They couldn't walk out because women had no resources, no money, no property. And what is a man going to do? He can't cut the cow in half and take it out of town or move half of the wheat field. Men and women were stuck together for thousands of years.
Mm.
And today, at least, people don't walk out of good marriages. They walk out of bad marriages. And bad marriages are really good for nobody, not even the children. And
in your research, what have been the top three reasons for a bad marriage to break up?
There's cultural ones, psychological ones, and biological ones. So the psychological ones is people can't, take somebody who watches too much television, who does a great deal of nagging. But the top one is adultery for both men and women. That the human animal does not share well. We're not good with adultery. That and a man who's sterile, a woman who's barren. If you look around the world, those are the three top ones: sterility, barrenness, and adultery. But after that, there's all the psychological ones: watching too much television, being gone constantly, lying regularly, being too cheap, being nasty around the house, being poor with the children, etc. Many, many reasons that people divorce. Social reasons are, you know, if you live in a small community where you've got a lot of people around you to support the relationship, that's much more likely to stay together than if you move to a city and you don't have anybody who knows both of you, and you have very different jobs with very different friends, etc. You're more likely to part. There's many biological, social, and psychological reasons for divorce. How about alcoholism or drug addiction, or there's many reasons for divorce. But there's many reasons to keep together too. And people, you know, they say that 50% of people divorce. 50% of people do not divorce in an age where it's relatively simple to do.
Oh, so you're an eternal optimist.
I am. In fact, David Bergen called me America's last optimist.
You know, let's talk about sex. You know, my wife needs a reason to have sex. I just need a place.
That's so great. Well, I think there's going to be the day when the world comes to realize that men are just as romantic as women, and that women are just as sexual as men, and that women aren't all going to think up a reason for sex. That, you know, we're leaving behind us 10,000 years of the belief that women are less sexual than men, and that kind of idea is still embedded in the culture. But when you ask people in hunting and gathering societies whether women are less sexual than men, they look at you as if you're crazy. They think that women are just as sexual as men are. I think we're going to come to understand that.
But then when you look at the role of media and you look at the role of culture, it always comes across that men are more sexual and that's all they want, and that women are not. And yet you're saying that women are just as sexual.
I'm saying that I think we're going to come to believe that women are sexual. They express it differently, you know. And what do you mean by sexual? That's another issue. For example, you know, in the bedroom, women have a better performance. I mean, they have many more contractions when they have an orgasm. They're much more likely to have multiple orgasms. They embed sex in more of their surroundings, silk sheets, beautiful flowers, or the lovely smells of perfume, the words that he says. Women are far more contextual than men are. I mean, men really define sex as having an orgasm, whereas women define sex as a much broader, the candlelight, the dinner, etc. So it's a question of what you regard as sex.
As what any other man regards as sex, I guess. I guess we're more focused.
You are more focused. In fact, the brain is more focused. But, you know, yeah, the male brain is more compartmentalized, and the female brain is more contextual. There's more circuits that go from one side of the brain to the other and from the front to the back. But, you know, a lot of these middle-aged women who say they don't want to have sex, if they had a new partner, they would be happy to have sex. They're just bored to tears with the one they've got.
So is it always the man's fault?
It's never just the man's fault. Mm. You know, men and women are like 2 feet. We need each other to get ahead. Our brains were built to work together. And I'm sort of tired of the American belief that everything is the man's fault. You know, I study men. I study women. We've spent 50 years trying to bust myths about women. It's time to bust all these myths about men. There's so much male bashing, and I feel almost sometimes like the only person in the world who's saying, look, men have tremendous attributes. They sacrifice continually for the wife and the family and for the community and for the nation and for the world.
Right. But then you're talking about sex. I mean, like, a lot of men wouldn't mind a one-night stand.
Yeah.
But you ask the women that, they sort of frown upon it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we're still from the animal kingdom.
Right.
And a one-night stand is not where you fall in love necessarily. It's just a short moment of joy, a short moment of pleasure. And when it's over, you move on or you move back. Philosophically, based on your research and your understanding, why do you think that is so wrong? Just because culture says it or our morals say it?
I'm not even sure it's entirely true. I study singles in America with Match.com. We don't poll the Match population. We poll Americans. It's a representative sample of singles based on the U.S. Census. And when I ask the question, have you ever had a one-night stand that turned into a long-term committed relationship, between 27 and 35% of men and women say yes. So a one-night stand isn't always a one-night stand. It very regularly turns into something else. But I do agree with you that, I mean, don't forget, you know, it's women that are going to get pregnant. It's women that are going to carry that embryo for 9 months. For millions of years, it was very dangerous to actually have a child. And then around the world, it's women who spend much more time raising children under the age of four. So women are the picky sex. There's no question about it. And they are more picky about one-night stands. It's interesting, though, among college kids, girls have much more sex than boys do. But that's because they can. Boys have.
How are they having more sex than the boys? Because you need the boy to have the sex.
You really wonder about that. It's like divorce. When I see divorce statistics for women and men, I wonder how come that can happen, too. The answer is, I don't. Well, don't forget that a woman.
Are they being bisexual, maybe?
No. I mean, look, a girl in a college can have sex with 10 men, and the same boy in college will end up having sex with one woman. So the woman's going to have more sex because she's got more partners.
Have you ever done research on our instincts as animals as opposed to what morals play in society?
You can't help but notice the issues involved in that. So I don't know if I've done any direct research on it, but it's certainly something that comes up in my reading all the time.
Because, you know... have you made any sort of observation on the typical traits of men as opposed to the typical traits of women?
Yes, I wrote a whole book on it. It's called The First Sex, The Natural Talents of Women and How They Changed the World. I would have talked about men, but men, it's women that's piling into the job market, and I wanted to know what they bring into the job market. And so, yes, I've studied this for many years of gender differences in the brain. And there are gender differences because for millions of years, men and women did different jobs. They sculpted different sorts of talents in the male and the female brain. Now, there's a lot of men who have a lot of female traits. There's a lot of women who have a lot of male traits. But on average, and when you look at the solid data of the brain and behavior, there are some real gender differences. And I'm very positive about the fact that women are piling into the job market and bringing all of these extra skills that I think are going to be very important in our modern world.
Well, going back to the sexuality side, what stops women from just responding to lust rather than love?
I'm not sure they do stop.
Well, let's be honest. A lot of men go to strip clubs. There are more strip clubs with women than there are with men.
Yeah. Well, you know, that book, 50 Shades of Grey, sold to 400 million women. 400 million. Now, that book is, I suppose, a little bit about romance, but it is basically about lust. And I think that as, you know, I mean, for 10,000 years, a woman's place was in the home. She, a virginity at marriage. Women were believed to be less sexual. We're just beginning to understand female sexuality. And I think we'll get to the point where we realize that women are just as lusty as men. They just express it differently.
Is it because they may be slower on the uptake when it comes to the topic of sexuality? Like, you know, men can be stupid in certain ways. But is it possible that women can be stupid in this way?
Stupid in which way?
Maturing sexually.
Oh, well, women around the world mature sexually faster than men do.
That's physically, but I'm talking about the desire, the maturity of desire.
It's entirely possible, yes, that they do. I think the peak of male sexuality is somewhere around age 18, and I think the peak of female sexuality is somewhere around age 25. And I often thought about that, but, you know, that's sort of interesting because maybe we evolved to have each sex be lustier at different times so that always there's somebody chasing somebody.
Well, I'm still waiting.
You're still waiting. Oh, God.
No, because, you know, when you said...
Women can be very sexual, by the way.
That's very true. But when you told me that that book, 50 Shades of Grey, that it sold 400 million copies, and majority of it to women, that really sparked an alert in my mind that obviously there is a certain amount of desire.
Right.
But it's being reflected through curiosity. They want to find out what's happening in that book.
No, they're trying to get ideas for themselves in the bedroom. I disagree entirely.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. Why else would you read that book? It's a terrible... Well, you know what that book did? It was a combination of a Harlequin novel of romance and a huge amount of sex and ideas about sex. And to my knowledge, the women who are reading that book are trying to get ideas about sex.
Were they trying to get ideas about sex, or were they sort of wanting to know what they were missing out on?
I think they're trying to get ideas about sex.
So you think a lot of them went back with a pair of handcuffs and some whips and saying to their husband, well, let's try it?
I don't know. Mm. I'm not in any of their bedrooms, but I do know that I think this is a huge play on a very, very simple and primordial sexual system. And I use what I call the iguana syndrome. What iguanas do, the little lizard, or horses, or cats, or dogs, or all kinds of animals, let's use iguanas. They bob their heads, they flap around, but a moment comes, and at that moment, the female squats down, tips up her buttocks, and totally surrenders. The male rushes up, puffs up, dominates, and if that combination of surrender and dominance is not played out, the copulation does not occur. And I actually think that all of this dominance and submission and, you know, S&M, all that kind of stuff, it's not about power. It's not about who dominates anybody in the boardroom or in the kitchen or with the children. It's about a very primitive male-female sexual interaction. And I think that's what was tapped into in 50 Shades of Grey. I don't think a lot of people are buying whips and chains. I don't know whether they are, but we didn't hear in the news that all these places that sell them are selling any more of them. But I think that they are feeding into fantasies that women will use in the bedroom to create a quality of surrender so that they can relax and have their orgasm.
That's very important. Talking about fulfilling their fantasy, as couples approach their midlife and they start developing these sort of midlife crises, when you've sort of spoken to people and done your research and things like that, do you find midlife crisis actually having an impact on the nature of love itself?
Yeah. I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't study midlife crises, so I just can't answer it. All kinds of things are going to have an impact on love. It's amazing how people will think that once you've married, you know, the relationship sort of stays the way it does. Mm-hmm. I know you don't think that. And in fact, it's constantly changing. And in good relationships, it's constantly evolving into new ideas, new things in the bedroom, new places to go together, familiar, wonderful memories that they have. I mean, you're building life's most important relationship with a partner. And these days, people do think it is. You know, if 100 years ago, you really had to marry the right person from the right clan, the right kin connection, the right social standing, the right political views, and hopefully from the farm next door. Today, we're not marrying for that. We're marrying for love. We want it all. We want that deep attachment. We want the intense romantic love. We want the sex drive, and we are working harder than at any time in human evolution to sustain those relationships.
But 100 years ago, they didn't have the internet, so they're equivalent of what you do at Match.com was to match the demographics as much as possible to increase the probability of maintaining the marriage.
Right, exactly. And it did increase the possibility, because if you're stuck on a farm, where are you going to go? And by the way, I mean, 100 years ago, women didn't have any career. Their only career path was to marry well and then to stick with it no matter how it changed. So I think we're at a very good time in relationships where you can walk out of something that really doesn't work in order to make something that does.
So is it possible to find love more than once?
Yes.
With the same intensity?
Yes. I've studied people. I've studied over 800 people and asked a questionnaire. And that brain circuitry for romantic love is like a sleeping cat. It can be awakened at any time. This is a brain system like the fear system or the anger system or the jealousy system. It is a basic brain system, and it can be just as strong if you're 70 years old as when you're 16.
So in that case, is it possible to love more than one person at any one given moment in time?
I think you've got to describe what you really regard as love. I do not think that you can be madly in love with two people at the same time. Part of the definition of being in love with somebody is that it's focused on one person. So if somebody says they're madly in love with two people, I would suspect that they don't love either of them that much. But I do think you can feel a deep attachment to one person, and then also feelings of intense romantic love for somebody else, and then also feelings of the sex drive for a third person. So these three brain systems, sex drive, romantic love, feelings of attachment, can be all for one person, or they can really be for different people at the same time, which makes it hard, you know, that we have to struggle with this.
But have you ever scanned someone who's in so-called love with two people?
No, I haven't.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of it.
It would be enormously interesting, and it's a wonderful suggestion on your part. But first of all, I don't think I'm going to find any. You know, you got to find somebody to put them in the machine, and because it's a sense. I mean, there's several core feelings of romantic love, and one of them is that it's focused on one person at a time. And I think that trait evolved millions of years ago to focus your mating energy on one person and start the mating process. So because that's such a central characteristic of romantic love, I think I'd have a hard time. Now, in the very beginning, you might be going out with two people or even three people, and, you feel some tinglings of romantic love for one and then the next and one, then the next. But things happen, times change, and you begin to focus all that mating energy on just one. That's romantic love.
Why are we the only animals in the animal kingdom that have this sense of wrongness to love more than once at any given point in time?
Because we're a pair bonding animal. Because for millions of years we needed to form a pair bond to rear our children. Monogamy. Mono means one, gammy means spouse. It doesn't mean you're sexually faithful to them. It means one pair, a pair bond. And along with that evolved our drive to fall madly in love, our drive for deep attachment, our jealousy towards, if our partner is flirting with somebody else. And we don't share well. We're not an animal that shares well. And so we've created various cultural precepts, cultural credos, that represent what's going on in the brain.
With your analysis of the brain, and with men in particular, are men sort of capable of being monogamous? I mean, they are, because they're forced by society and their wives, but given a free rein, I would doubt if they could be capable of monogamy.
All right. First of all, every single time a man is sleeping around, a vast amount of time he's sleeping around with a woman. So there's a great many women who are being adulterers as well.
Right.
And I've studied adultery, the whole evolution of it, the brain circuitry of it, and the social patterns of it since the 1920s when we've got our first records. And these days, among people under the age of 40, women are just as adulterous as men. Now, so instead of a gender difference, I think there's quite similar. Nevertheless, there's some men who are naturally don't cheat. There's some women who naturally don't cheat. I don't think this is a gender difference as much as it is a human variation. There's some people who drink too much. There's some people who smoke too much. There's some people who eat too much. There's some people who cheat. And there's just as many women these days as men.
So what is it, when you've done the analysis and the study, what was it in the brain circuitry that makes someone engage in adultery?
There's a lot. There's a very interesting study of, and it comes out of Sweden, and they looked at 552 men, and they studied a particular gene in the vasopressin system. And this gene, you can have no copies of the gene, one copy of the gene, or two copies of the gene. And what they found is that men with no copies of that gene had the most stable marriages. Now, they weren't studying adultery, but they were studying the stability of a marriage, which can lead to adultery. So men with no copies of that gene had the most stable marriages. Men with one copy had less stable marriages, and men with two copies had the least stable marriages. So we know of one gene in the vasopressin system. We also know of a gene in the dopamine system that apparently plays a role in sleeping around. And, of course, these three different brain systems. I mean, you can feel deep attachment for one person and then also swing into feelings of wild romantic love or the sex drive for somebody else. So the brain enables you to love more than one person at a time.
But your studies are predicting the state of a marriage. I'm talking about someone's ability to go out and cheat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people who cheat presumably are married. So
yeah.
I think this has something to do with this. And we do think that certain genes incline you more to cheating. What's really interesting, though, is one study that shows that when they asked men and women who would cheat who were married, 56% of men and 34% of women said that they were in a happy marriage. They cheated when they were in a happy marriage.
So are they adrenaline junkies?
They may be novelty junkies. I wrote a whole article on infidelity, who, when, where, and why. You can find it on my website, helenfisher.com. But I go through all of the cultural and biological reasons for adultery and don't have time to do that here. But there are some people who are going to be more predisposed for biological reasons, but also cultural reasons. Some people want to get caught and break up their marriage. Some people want to get caught and get out of their marriage. Some people want to supplement their marriage. Some people get lonely when their partner's out of town. Some people want to solve a sex problem. Some people want sex with somebody different. Some people have sex because they're so angry at their partner. There's many, many reasons, psychological reasons, but I also think that there's evolutionary reasons.
So there are a lot of reasons that actually can justify it. There are very few reasons that actually where the person committing the act is actually wanting to harm the person they're with.
Very often it has, yes. You know, people will say, well, it has nothing to do with you. And from their perspective, they actually mean that.
Right.
Well, the problem is when you find out it has a lot to do with you because you're so hurt. We don't share well. But yeah, I mean, for millions of years, dialing back a million years, they've got a couple on the grasslands of Africa. They've got two children. The man slips over the hill and has sex with somebody else and has two extra children. He will have spent twice the amount of DNA into his future.
Mm.
Those children would live and pass on whatever it is in the brain that predisposes him to adultery. But why would a woman be adulterous? She can't have a new child every single time she sleeps around, but she can get extra resource, extra meat, extra protection, an insurance policy. If her husband dies or deserts her, somebody can step in. So through millions of years of having this have some genetic payoffs, we've evolved in the human animal a tremendous drive to fall in love, form a pair bond, rear our children as a team, and also a predisposition to adultery. We all handle this in our own little way. Some people are faithful all their lives and don't have any interest in sleeping around. Other people have terrible times forming a pair bond.
So is there any sort of drug or treatment that can actually decrease love?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really appreciate it. You know, all these people who take... okay, so we're talking about romantic love, I'm assuming. So romantic love, we found in the brain, is linked with the dopamine system. This system is what gives you the focus, the motivation, the craving, the electrical energy, the elation, etc.
Hmm.
And when you take an SSRI, a serotonin booster, like Prozac or Paxil or Lexapro, the more recent ones, you're driving up the serotonin system in the brain. And the serotonin system dampens the dopamine system. And I think that it can not only numb you, but jeopardize your ability to fall in love and stay in love. I've written a good deal about this. I've got to do the basic research on it. But I do know I get a letter once a week from somebody around the world who says, you know, I have had a wonderful relationship with my wife. We've got two wonderful boys. We've been married for 13 years. She suddenly got on one of these serotonin boosters. And, you know, last week she came to me and said, I don't have any feelings for you. I don't love you anymore, and I don't want to have this marriage. Hmm. And it's because, you know, she's taken a drug. Now, there's some people who need these serotonin boosters.
Well, my wife would love to give me the drug, but I'd be out of my mind.
But you'd leave her, too. I mean, she wouldn't want that because, I mean, it may reduce your sex drive, but it'll also reduce your feelings.
No, but who in their right mind would recommend this?
Say that again?
Who in their right mind, which doctor would recommend this to a patient?
Well, that's a very good point because doctors aren't looking at that. People walk in with terrible depression, and they want to solve that, and they don't study love. They study depression. And some of them don't even bother to tell you that it's going to kill your sex drive. It kills your sex drive in 73% of people.
You think? Well, oh, my God.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of people who say, well, that's fine with me. I'm so depressed, I don't care. I need to be over my depression, which I understand. But then they stay on the drug, and then they realize they not only have no sex drive, but they're not making an effort to fall in love. They don't, you know, these drugs numb the emotions.
Does it also numb your ambition and your drive just to do well in life?
I don't know about that. I would say not. I would say that it doesn't affect that part of the mind.
Because people who are usually ambitious have a high sex drive, too. There is that sort of certain correlation.
Yeah, because...
But if you remove the sex drive, you're also removing the level of ambition in a person, I would think. I mean...
There's no data on that. We do know that it reduces the sex drive. We know that. There's a lot of data on that in about 75% of people. Not everybody.
That's horrific. Oh,
but there's no data that it does reduce, however, and they never tell you this, it reduces exploratory behavior. So you're less creative when you take those drugs.
Oh, my wife would love that.
Oh, dear.
No, because she makes me do all the routine stuff at home, which I find really boring. But now, you know, she'd probably slip that pill into something I'm drinking.
Yeah.
So that I'd enjoy the hoovering and all that.
She's going to lose your attachment to her. And she wants that.
So talking about, you know, relationships, what's the secret? Give me three tips on making a marriage or a relationship work.
Well, there's all kinds of psychologists who will give you a whole lot of good tips. I can only add what the brain says. And what the brain says is empathy for your partner, controlling your own emotions, focusing on the positive rather than the negative, stay in touch, hugging, kissing, holding hands, sitting next to each other on the couch when you watch television instead of two different easy chairs. Learn to sleep in the person's arms, at least in the beginning. Any kind of touch drives up the oxytocin and can sustain feelings of attachment. To sustain feelings of romantic love, do novel things together. Novelty drives up the dopamine system and can help sustain feelings of romantic love. And certainly also have sex. Sex not only sustains feelings of romantic love and feelings of attachment, but it drives up the testosterone system so that you want more sex. Sex is very good for a relationship if you like the person. And last but not least, say at least three nice things to the person every day. It not only reduces their cholesterol and their cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and boosts their immune system, but it helps yours. It's healthy to say nice things to your partner.
You see, I like the sex bit.
Well, I like the sex and the romance and the attachment. I like all of it.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, sex is so relative because sometimes when the women are silent and don't tell their partner that they're not fully satisfied.
Yeah, a mistake.
You need to bring everything what you've said into the sex bit as well because it's a form of communication.
And that is a great, great point. Men really want to please. This one study I did with Match.com, and I asked, you know, how important is to please yourself as opposed to your partner? Men are much more eager to please their partner than themselves, and women are much more eager to please themselves. And so women have to tell men how to please. And young women are so shy, they don't dare do that, so they go on for years and years pretending, which doesn't help anybody.
And That's where I was said earlier on that women are mentally, sexually not mature because they are so shy in expressing what they want.
Yeah.
That men are sometimes lost. Okay, if I try this and then, you know, that doesn't work, or I'm not getting feedback, I'm not getting output from the input. So it sort of, and men are very happy to say, oh, I like this and I like that. Can you do this? Can you do that?
Yeah. I actually have not found men can easily say what they want. They're always saying, oh, it's fine, it's fine. They're so scared.
They're just lucky they're getting some. You know what? That's the
only thing. Yeah, they're getting some. But I don't regard this as immature on women's part. I regard it as placating, as trying to please. Now, if you call that immaturity, that's fine, and maybe it is. But the bottom line is women get older, they are more and more likely to, A, know what they want, and B, ask the person. And actually, you know, I think sex can get better and better in a marital relationship because you begin to dare tell the person what works.
Yeah, my fear is that in some relationships, women have sort of in their minds discounted the value of sex and they sort of do it as an act of doing a favor. It's a bit like, you know, it's raining and then I go open the door of the car for my wife. Well, I'm getting extra wet, but I just do it because it's just a gentleman thing to do. And some women in their sexual relationships, they're not getting satisfied, but they just think, you know what, I'll let him have his way. It's my way of, you know, contributing to the relationship.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you're saying that because I'll never forget, I was a very young woman and I was going out with a man and I suggested that we go to bed. And he turned to me and said, you know, Helen, one of the best held secrets of men is that they don't always want to do it. And that they...
Throw him aside. I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, you clearly do not. But there's a lot of men in the world who do an awful lot of things for women when they are too tired themselves. So I'm not going to buy into the fact that all women are, you know, just doing it to you know, don't want to do it, and all men do.
So has science proved, I mean, in your study, what are the three things that really sort of surprised you?
Oh, boy.
That were different from your life's experiences to what you found.
Oh, boy. Well, I think love is an addiction. I've proven that in the brain. A wonderful addiction when it's going well, a perfectly terrible one then when it's not.
Mm.
That's very important. That this is a brain system. We've proven it. We're the first in the world to prove it. You know, a lot of people have felt that romantic love was a part of the supernatural. We don't think that depression or fear or anger is part of the supernatural, but we've been able to prove that this is a real brain system. It starts in early childhood, long before the sex drive. It's more powerful than the sex drive. You know, if you casually ask somebody to go to bed with you and they say no, thank you don't kill yourself. But around the world, the amount of rejected people who go for stalking, clinical depression, suicide, homicide, all of our crimes of passion coming from this very powerful addiction. I would call it the mother of all addictions. Wonderful addiction when it's going well and a perfectly dreadful one when it's going poorly. I think that's one of the main things that I've discovered. I think the fact that, you know, we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems, the sex drive, romantic love, and attachment, and how all three of them operate in all kinds of ratios so that you love your child but don't want to have sex with it, you know, love your job but don't want to have sex with it, you know, can feel madly in love with a new baby but don't want to have sex with it, et cetera. I just understanding the brain and this thing about happiness that I just said to you, I mean, you know, what makes a happy relationship? We know some of these things now. We can apply them. We can make happier marriages. And I think perhaps the last thing is that women are piling into the job market, and what we're seeing is a return to equality in marriages, which I think is very important. The double income family, and I think we're moving towards better marriages because bad relationships can end before you tie the knot. I'm very optimistic, as you know, about the future.
So where can people buy your books, The Anatomy of Love?
Well, the new one, Anatomy of Love, a second edition. Don't buy the first one. That came out in 1992, and it's way out of date. It's the second edition, I hope, in any bookstore. I read the book aloud, so I think you can buy an audio edition that I think has come out.
Okay, and how can people get in touch with you? What's your website?
I've got two of them. HelenFisher.com is my personal one, and then with my brain scanning partner, TheAnatomyOfLove.com.
Dr. Fisher, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your experience with us.
And thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my Twitter account at VipJaswal and my Facebook page. Just type in VipJaswal Report. A special shout-out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern with more fascinating stories that fill our lives with the inspiration and information we so need to kickstart the week. Wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your loved ones, and until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy weekend.